ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon, Selena Green with you on this Friday. Well, disappointment this week for those who are keen to see some federal budget money for a major sail yards upgrade here in South Australia. I'll come back to that in just a moment. Also, have you ever tried chickpeas as a crop? If you're growing them, do let me know where, if you're planning to grow any more. 1300 222 891, you can give me a call or send me a text on 0467 922 891. I ask because the world's largest consumer of chickpeas just dumped some huge tariffs of them coming out of Australia.
And I think it's a great time when they've dropped it. Now guys have got an opportunity to actually change it up, grow some chickpeas where they probably weren't going to because there wasn't the access to the market as what it is now.
If that's you, I'd love to hear from you today. But first, maybe back to the drawing board for plans to revamp one of the state's busy sail yards. The District Council of Grant is going to re-evaluate the future of the Mount Gambier Sail Yards Transformation Project following an unsuccessful federal government funding bid. The council didn't get the $7 million it had hoped to secure as part of the Growing Regions program to make some key upgrades to the site. Grant Council Mayor Kylie Boston says it was pretty disappointing.
We now will just wait to receive the feedback from the Better Regions, Growing Regions program. We've yet to receive that feedback yet, so that's the first step in the process to see why we were unsuccessful, and then we'll sit down as the Sail Yard Committee and as Council and have a look at where we go now.
Is it still important to pursue?
Oh, most definitely. We, as council, we're very committed to this. We know how important the sail yards brings in more than $150 million back to the region annually. And that's just what it does through the sail yards. And we know there's a flow-on effect to everybody within our council area as well as within Mount Gambier too. So it's an extremely important project. We're very passionate about it. It's been operating very successfully for 40 years and we know it's got a future. We do know we do have ageing infrastructure there, hence there was a need for the upgrade. So we just need to sit down now and have a look at how we'll go about it. It was the funding we received from state government was an election promise. We'll sit down and go back to state government, have a look at what that looks like with them now as well.
Yeah, well, are there other opportunities here through other funding channels, state government, other grant opportunities?
That's what we'll have to go back and reevaluate. We've, at this stage, the Growing Regions is about, as it said, Growing Regions and economic development. So we'll go back and have a look. They do have another round of funding available with that, but there's been no indication of what time frame that's on. So we'll have to have a look and see. We felt that we hit all of the points with what we needed within this. And yeah, it was very disappointing to miss out on this when we got the notification yesterday. I'd also like to note, unfortunately no projects. I think there were three projects that were up in the Limestone Coast and there were no projects that received funding in the Limestone Coast out of this federal bucket of money.
Yeah, how important were these upgrades, Mayor Boston? Just remind us of that.
Very important because it's about us moving into the next stage of options market system and selling system. So for us, it was very important around our animal welfare standards and that to get this roofing on so that we can get soft wool in there and make these changes to our pen. So it is very important moving forward. So that's what we'll sit down and have a look at and find another way of doing this.
Is the yard still viable? Can it go on without these upgrades?
Most definitely it is in the short term, but we do know that it is, as I said, it's ageing infrastructure. So we do know that we need to be looking at these options.
Is there a concern that if something's not done now, the cost estimate would be significantly more, you know, if these things aren't attended to soon?
It's always a concern until we go back out to the market. We were shovel ready ready to go, because you were supposed to start your project on Wednesday, I think it was. So interesting, they announced this on the Thursday when everyone's projects were supposed to start on the Wednesday. So we were ready to go. So that's part of what we'll have to go back and reevaluate.
Grant District Council, as you say, shovel ready to get this underway. $7 million being requested. Why do you think this has been such a drawn out and complicated process?
I'm not sure. We had to have it in January. We were told we were going to find out in March, but the date was just put out on the, it kept putting out on their website. So we're hoping that some of the information that we'll get with the letter to say that we're unsuccessful. There was also the contact details to get the information about why we were unsuccessful. So that's what we've requested that yesterday afternoon, and we'll wait and see what comes back.
That's the Mayor of Grant District Council, Kylie Boston, speaking with Beck Chave. It's 10 minutes past 12. Well, pulse growers across the country are expected to benefit from a recent decision by the Indian government to suspend a 66% tariff on imported desi chickpeas. India is the world's biggest consumer of chickpeas, but we haven't been able to export them there since the tariffs began way back in 2017. Well, the CEO of Grain Producers SA, Brad Perry, told me that while our state isn't a huge producer of chickpeas, still welcome news.
Yeah, it's something that we called on, Selena, back when some of the other tariffs were reduced and removed from India, that chickpeas were sort of left out of that. So it's really good to see that the tariffs have been suspended. You know, we're not a huge producer here in South Australia on the national scale, but we certainly make a strong contribution. About 36,000 tonnes have been produced in South Australia over the past 5 years on average. So we may see that increase. You know, it's a market demand. So, you know, we've seen chickpea prices jump up to $1,000. So, it's, you know, things are moving in that space already after the announcement from the Indian government.
Why has it not been a larger crop here in South Australia in the past? Is it because of that demand issue, or is it because of climate? You know, why haven't we grown more chickpeas in the past?
I think it's several factors at play, but it's always market demand. So we're going to grow, you know, where the market availability is, where the price is. So it's always that demand that dictates what goes in the ground. So hopefully the suspension of the tariffs will see a little bit more consideration of putting chickpeas in, and you know, certainly a staple food of the Indian population and other populations around the world as well. So we'll hopefully continue to contribute to that.
That is Grain Producers SA's Brad Perry. Well, Mark Schilling farms on the York Peninsula, and he's also the Southern Region Director with Grain Producers Australia. He told me he's grown chickpeas before, but it's not been in high demand of late.
Look, in the past, we've grown lots of chickpeas, predominantly the Kabuli type. And, you know, the Desi type, which is the real liquid market, they're predominantly grown in the eastern states, top of northern Victoria, right through to, you know, I think up to central Queensland. And, you know, being a legume, they're a good sustainability crop where, you know, they produce their own nitrogen for the following crop, for wheat or for barley. You know, you don't have to use as much nitrogen. So, you know, the Indian government has dropped the tariff on chickpeas. And look, that's just, you know, supply demand. The Indian government obviously, you know, got to feed a lot of people there. And I think it's a great time when they've dropped it, because in the eastern states, I think there's a bit of stop-go, because it's too wet in some parts of New South Wales. So now guys have got an opportunity to actually change it up, grow some chickpeas where they probably weren't going to, because there wasn't the access to the market as what it is now with no tariffs.
The Desis and the Kabulis, is it obviously they're both chickpeas, but they have their different uses. Are they quite a different market depending on which one you're growing? Is it, or do they tend to follow the same market?
Like, yeah, so a Kabuli is tended to be sold as a whole Kabuli chickpea, and then, you know, they'll use that as a dal as well. But predominantly, like a desi type is done with a dal. So when I call a dal, that means they take the skin off and split it, and basically it's a dal that they use in their, you know, everyday cooking. Like, it's their staple. you know, maybe we, us, some of us Australians probably should eat some of that good protein pulse occasionally. And, you know, that's what that culture is being brought up on, and that's why it's such a big fluid market.
So when you've grown it in the past, was it more because, was it a sort of a market or demand thing, or was it is because it is such a good crop for rotation there?
It's rotation. Like, you know, chickpeas, lentils, peas, it's about a rotation. And, you know, it's interesting how we've seen the shift, and I'd love to do a graph on the last 10 years of how our pulses have dominated. Like, our pulse used to be just the break crop. Now it's cash crop. Now, whether that's a chickpea or lentil or a pea, you know, we're all going towards the high gross margin, which is a lentil. You know, at 800 to 950 a tonne at the moment, it's pretty hard to walk away and replace lentils with chickpeas when they probably... Well, they're trading pretty good at the moment, $1,000 a tonne, but they're not as adapted to southern Australia as what a lentil is. And vice versa, a lentil isn't adapted as well in the eastern states like a chickpea is. So, you know, we each have our different nuances when it comes to growing, and, yeah, probably southern Australia is more suited to lentils and peas.
This lifting of the tariffs, this is particularly on Desi chickpeas, but you see this as potentially being a good news story for anyone growing pulses.
Oh, well, it's immense in to the market that they're looking for a protein. And so, you know, if traditionally what can happen is if one protein source gets too dear, they swap to the other one. But now you're obviously seeing a real big shift that no tariffs are on, so that means they want as much as they can. So you're going to be seeing the prices be very, very stable. But I don't see a lot of downside going into harvest this coming year unless, you know, something falls out of bed.
You never know what's around the corner.
Oh, well, we live in a world of uncertainty, don't we?
Absolutely.
And, you know, you wake up in the morning, you think, okay, who's going to blow up or, you know, do something today? Because that's what markets react to quite fluidly right now is, you know, the wheat market does the same. As soon as somebody drops a bomb or throws a missile across a ship, the markets go haywire. So, yeah, it's just-in-time commodity trading which is happening.
This tariff decision, does this mean you're more likely now to put chickpeas back into your rotation?
Unfortunately, mine's been set in concrete, and it's all lentils, wheat lentils. Chickpeas are probably not in our rotation this year, as I sort of alluded to, that southern Australia, and it's just the makeup of chickpeas, they're more suited to those northern hemisphere climates, more humidity, etc. Whereas what happens with a chickpea, unlike a lentil will flower quite in cooler conditions, whereas a chickpea, we've seen it a couple of years where they abort their flowers when we get colder weather, and they just tend not to yield as prolific as what a lentil does. So that's why, you know, we are seeing a bit of a, you know, downturn in chickpeas, but certainly the Kibbouleys in southern Victoria, they're quite prevalent down through their Horsham area. You know, PB Seeds has a fairly big following of people growing chickpeas down through that area.
That is York Peninsula farmer Mark Schilling, taking us to 18 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's time to check in and see how vintage has been going. Some of our keen wine-growing regions, it's nearly done for many of those regions. And in the Clare Valley, the grapes have all been picked. Quantity, I'm told, was down with some frost late last year and then some minor heat waves during harvest. But the good news is the quality is good. Marnie Roberts is owner and winemaker at Matriarch and Rogue Wines. Says they got a nice little burst of heat in March, which has helped finish off the flavour.
So everything's in, thank goodness. We had a few latecomers. Obviously, Claire had a bit of a frost in October last year at the start of the growing period, which affected a few areas. But interestingly enough, a few of the varieties that we had sort of threw a second crop and actually came through and developed a really lovely flavour and crop load as well. So I think as a growing season, it was fairly standard. It was a little bit drier than we wanted, but we did get a nice little burst of heat just at the time we needed it in March, just to finish flavour ripening and push the fruit through. And then it was quite a condensed time of picking. There was sort of a window of a week to get all the Riesling from around the area in. Everyone was manic picking and it was quite full on. And then, you know, because I have different varieties that have different ripening, they were sort of spread out throughout the vintage. But overall the quality and the flavour profile of the wines looks fantastic. So we did have quite a hot period towards the end of March, April, which we would have all felt. And anything that was off sort of before then has beautiful, pure fruit expression. Anything after that is quite intense and big. So yeah, you had to really be on your toes and think quick, but it was good.
Out of the 10 different varieties that you have coming in, what are you most excited about in terms of the fruit this year?
Oh, that's really hard. Yeah. I mean, I think this year the quality of the Riesling is up there. I think it's lovely. I think last year we had a cooler ripening period, so there was a different profile of fruit. And this year it's less about acid and more about flavour, which is lovely. I think that the one that I'm watching that is still developing in tank is Fiano. Had a really lovely passion fruit character to it this year. And a lot of full flavours in it and a really nice acid profile. So that was exciting. And the other one that is interesting as well is a little vineyard in Watervale, and that's got a Primitivo on it, which is some people know as a Zinfandel. So I'm pretty keen to see how that goes in barrel.
Marnie Roberts, owner and winemaker of Matriarch and Rogue Wines, discussing the Clare vintage. Likewise at Killiconoon Wines, viticulturalist Troy Van Dolken says the ripening conditions were excellent.
Another classic year in Clare, so, you know, these really warm, cool, dry seasons are fantastic for the valley, really. So it just allows us to get all our fruit in at the right time. And even though there was a couple of little heat waves through the season, it was lots and lots of fruit out there, but the fruit that was there, it was pretty good quality. Did you hear about the frost that we had? So, you know, there was a pretty severe frost we had through the valley in October last year, and it sort of took out about 20% or thereabouts valley's fruit. But apart from that, I think, you know, the overall quality out of the valley was very, very good.
Viticulturalist for Killiconoon Wines, Troy Van Dolken, speaking with Kate Higgins. Well, in Cootawarra, vintage is also wrapped up. Winemakers seem to be overall pretty happy with the quality of the wine, but the season wasn't without its problems. Cootawarra Vignerons Executive Officer Hugh Coff says growing conditions were a bit unusual this year.
I think that several of our viticulturalists and several of our winemakers have actually talked about this as being a vintage like any other we've had in the modern era, quite frankly. We've had some very big influences, such as the El Nino influence, which was provided, I suppose, in the growing season with a warmer and drier, you know, period of time, which was a preceding winter. And then that resulted, of course, in an earlier bud burst, and that got us going for the season. And of course, we've had the Bonnie upwelling, which is that just phenomenal oceanic event which occurs off the limestone coast every year. But the fact that it was incredibly strong this year meant that the ocean waters were incredibly colder than what they've normally been. And that then certainly moderated the weather, you know, right through, particularly the nighttime temperatures through that sort of December and well into the new year, which was just phenomenal. So it's been a remarkable lot of climatic conditions, which have then been finished off with an exceptionally dry period through late summer and autumn.
So how did wine growers then kind of cope with all of those different things happening? They were able to get a bit of success still?
Absolutely. The end result of all that activity has actually been that when we actually look at, say, the white wines particularly, and they were obviously picked earlier in the season than what the reds were, but there were some very good acids, some very firm acid they've described as being in the whites, and also some really great fruit flavours which came out of that, particularly in the Rieslings and the Chardonnays. But what has probably come about when the reds have been described by many as being a very strong red wine vintage, and we've got some very intense colours, some bold tannins, and some great depth of that varietal fruit flavour that we, which we always like to have a look at, and they're the very early indicators of a vintage of the highest quality, and they often will translate then, of course, into wines which have the excellent cellaring potential as well, and we're delighted to see what the results of they will be.
So quality's still really high then, Hugh, but did growers get the amount of grapes, the yields they were hoping for?
Yeah, there was a bit of cold weather and a bit of frost around, if we remember back in spring. So that cold, wet weather in November and December was throughout that flowering period. And the fruit set, as a result, probably resulted in some low to moderate yields, although
There's also been some reports of some higher yields than that as well. But I think overall for Coonawarra, it's going to be a time when you've got, potentially when you've got less grapes on the vine, you've got generally a higher quality as well. So those low to moderate yields are going to be interesting what they turn out like when we finally get the crash report.
And this is the first year in a while, Hugh, that some of these grapes, at least winemakers know for sure that they might be able to be sold into China. Is that changing the optimism of vintage and how things are going?
I think the beauty of vintages occurs every year, and you've always got a fair idea of what needs to be done. And you're right, the selling and the style and the way that we are looking at China is obviously very different to when it was 4 years ago when it first closed. So China's going to be a very slow burn for the wine industry, particularly for Coonawarra. It's certainly released the pressure valve. I think there was certainly some more optimism around for this year, and we saw certainly some signs of that. But I think there's a fair bit of time to go before we actually see what that's all about. But more importantly, while we've got such great quality and such premium product coming out of Coonawarra, that's always going to keep us in good stead in all our markets. So we really look forward to seeing whether there's some tremendous amount of export opportunity with the premium grapes which are coming for the last couple of years, and indeed back into the domestic market to try and actually get people back to drinking, you know, more still red wine again. And of course, Coonawarra with their Cabernets do that as best as anyone in the world.
Executive Officer of Coonawarra Vignerons, Hugh Coff, speaking with Elsie Adamo. 25 minutes past 12, off to the Bureau. Jenny Horvat, hello and happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Selena, to you and your listeners.
And it seems like we haven't really had much of a change when it comes to talking about the weather, unfortunately.
No, that's right. So that high pressure system is still south of WA, but it is sort of edging close and it'll be situated south of the Bight by the end of the day. And it's going to linger there as we head into the weekend. So we did see another cold start in parts this morning, seeing those minimum temperatures getting down to -1.4 degrees at Yunta on Eyre Peninsula there, Woodna just above 0 degrees, Ceduna 0.7 of a degree, Kynecutter 1.5. So a little bit of a cold start again, and we did see quite a lot of fog around this morning as well, especially across the southeastern districts and even across Eyre Peninsula and the West Coast district this morning. And as we head into the weekend, we are looking at similar mornings. Cold front across Tasmania this morning, and we've got a tail end of that cloud around the southeast this morning. Couldn't rule out a little bit of light shower activity around there today, but looking at the gauges, we haven't gauged anything on our side of the border, and only sort of 0.4 of a millimetre at Portland there. So there wasn't a lot in there, and it would be brief and light if we did see anything during the day there. So that all disappear relatively quickly for a dry Saturday coming up. So again, maybe some fog across the agricultural area Saturday morning, and we are looking at a cold to very cold morning across the southeast, and we do have a frost warning that has been issued for the upper southeast and lower southeast forecast districts for Saturday morning. As we head into Sunday, again, we are looking at a very cold morning in parts, maybe more broadly across the agricultural area. So keep an eye out for those frost warnings that will be issued tomorrow for the Sunday morning. That high pressure system sitting south of the Bight is going to maintain a bit of a southerly airstream as we head into the weekend. So those maximum temperatures being probably slightly below average as we head into Saturday and Sunday. And with maybe that southerly airstream, we might see a little bit of moisture starting to push up on some of those coastal districts on Sunday. So some light showers not out of the question there. And as we head into early next week, again, that high pressure system still situated south of the Bight there with that southerly airstream. Again, maybe some of that light shower activity trying to push inland across the southern agricultural area, but really probably more likely about the coastal fringe. And again, we're really not expecting too much with that. In the middle to next week there, Tuesday, Wednesday, we'll start to see that high pressure system starting to move east, those winds turning a little bit more southeasterly. And those showers really on the Tuesday around coastal parts really starting to ease up to a mainly fine as we head towards the end of the week there. So just having a look at some of those cumulative rainfall totals that we are expecting up until the end of Tuesday, really across that southern agricultural area on the Sunday and Monday, probably less than a millimetre at best, and maybe on some of our southern coasts and ranges could pick up a little bit more over a couple of days there, but still looking at less than probably 3 millimetres, maybe the isolated fall over a couple of days pushing 5 millimetres, but you would be lucky, I think, Selena. It is still looking like a very dry period for the state.
All right, thanks, Jenny. Enjoy the rest of your Friday.
No worries. Thank you.
That's Jenny Horvat there from the Weather Bureau. The forecast for the upper western parts of, the western inland parts of New South Wales for both the upper and western district, both expecting a sunny day tomorrow and both expecting southerly winds 25 to 35 k's an hour, with overnight temperatures in the upper western district between 8 and 11, daytime temperatures between 16 and 20. For the lower western district, overnight between 4 and 7, with those daytime temperatures reaching around 16 degrees. It is coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. You're with Selena Green. In this next half an hour, a major announcement to do with water supply for the north of our state. And a very good afternoon and happy Friday to you, Selena Green, bringing you the South Australian Country Hour again today. I'm here for you until 1 o'clock. Well, there's been a major announcement today. It's all about delivering water to the state's north and supporting renewables projects in the area, along with, hopefully, some jobs. I'm going to cross to our reporter there in just a moment. Also, are you planning on Friday night fish and chips? Well, if you're buying flake, thinking that it's gummy shark, how sure can you be that it is actually what it claims to be? Turns out a lot of it is mislabeled.
Essentially, what we found was that a large number, in fact 70% of the samples, were mislabeled. That is, the label was either uninformative or the label didn't correspond to the species of origin.
So if it's not gummy shark, what is it? Well, you have to stick around to find out. Also, you know what goes well with fish and chips on a Friday? A nice cold beer. Well, you'll meet a South Australian brewer who's making beer with camel dung. Yes, camel dung. And if you can tell me a stranger product being used in brewing, then you'd better let me know about it. My talkback number's 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. This is all to come after headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, Snowtown Murders accomplice Mark Ray Hayden has been released to live in the community with strict supervision after spending 25 years in jail. The head of the parole board, Francis Nelson, says that Hayden, who was an accessory to Australia's worst serial killings, left the Adelaide Pre-Release Centre, where he has been living on parole. The Public Hospital Doctors Union says the Royal Adelaide Hospital Emergency Department has been overwhelmed all week. It says over 50 patients have been left waiting for a bed at numerous times this week. The union says staff numbers and hospital resources are not able to meet demand for mental health services. And the Transport Minister Tom Koutsantonis says the government is exploring plans to modify the southeastern freeway exit to make it safer. It follows another truck rollover at the Crossroad intersection earlier this week, which caused peak hour traffic delays and closed the road until mid-afternoon. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Well, you know the saying, harder to find than a needle in a haystack. It seems the haystack itself is difficult to find at the moment. Hay supplies are dwindling fast as the dry start to 2024 across South Australia and other parts of the country starts to bite. Corbin Schuster is a hay producer at Freeling, and he told me inquiries have significantly ramped up lately and they're coming out of some new locations.
Yeah, so we supply the horse industry, like domestic horse industry around South Australia and interstate with hay bales. And yeah, the dry conditions that have been persisting are really starting to pick up with the number of phone calls that I'm receiving that the feed out in paddocks is really starting to deplete now, and people are looking for those other sources. And yeah, people up in the hills are really starting to run out, so we're starting to get calls from people up in the hills and around the state, just people looking for hay to tie them over until such time as the rains come.
Yeah, are these usual places that you would get inquiries from around this time of the year, or is it a little bit more widespread this time?
It is a lot more widespread. So we're facing probably at Freeling here, we've really had the driest start in about over 100 years. And I think if there's no rain for the rest of the month, which it looks like there's going to be no rain for the rest of the month, we could be staring down the driest start on record. So, but the crazy part is it's such a large geographic spread of dry conditions from Ceduna to Burra to Keith, really. So yeah, we're most of our, just because of the, I guess, the freight and logistics side of things, most of our inquiries are coming from the Adelaide Hills, but a lot of those producers up there who might normally do enough round bales or small square bales to see their customers through, if they've run out in April or running out now, and there's still that 5 month feed gap for people to get through.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hearing that round bales are pretty much almost impossible to get a hold of at the moment. Is that right?
Yes, correct. Yeah, I mean, I think what happened was last year's hay was exceptional quality, but there wasn't a heck of a lot produced due to probably, I would say, a lot of carryover from 2022, because 2022 was a hay year that I'd rather forget. Mm. And a lot of people had this lower quality hay stored in their sheds. And I thought, well, I'm not doing a heap this year, but last year, talking about. But yeah, last year's hay was fantastic quality, which is a bit of a saving grace, I guess. It will extend further. I guess the bale of last year's hay is going to be worth a lot more in terms of feed quality than a 2-year-old bale from 2022. So.
What's this doing for prices? Obviously, supply and demand, that's going to be pushing sort of the prices of things up?
It is, yeah. So the price has crept up a little bit. I guess the thing is, it's just a matter of being able to get it. It may come to a point, because I know there's west of us, there's quite a few producers out there who only do round bales, which service the horse industry and the domestic, like the, I guess, horses as pets or companion animals, and they've all run out now. And the harder thing is, it's almost a domino effect, because every producer makes enough hay for their standard customers. They might do a tiny bit of carry, a tiny bit of surplus. But if one person runs out, then all of that person's customers go on to the next person and then chews up their surplus really, really quickly. And it just becomes a runaway effect. So, I've been doing a few Ks in the last week, middle of seeding, which is probably not the easiest time to go around and try and search for hay. But I've been trying to buy up a little bit of hay just to get us through in terms of with what we do, where we process the big square bales into small square bales for the horse market. And yeah, we've definitely noticed it was probably quiet in February and March, but now people have started cotton on that actually there's really no rain falling, and even if rain was to fall now, you wouldn't really have any decent feed in the paddocks for kind of 4 to 6 weeks. So there is still a significant gap where animals are going to have to be fed before there's anything available on the paddocks.
Yeah, so those small square bales is pretty much what left of what people will be able to get, but they are going to be a bit harder to source from here on out.
I think so, yeah. Look, there are some large square bales around, but the thing is, it's like the blocks that built the pyramid. They're not really that easy to kind of handle. So that's why people have always, up in the hills especially, people have always preferred the round bales. I guess small square bales are more convenient to handle, but there is that kind of price premium attached to them. But yeah, I'm probably fielding now, at the moment, I'm probably fielding 5 to 10 phone calls a day from people who I've never really been in contact with, who are just looking for round bales.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there's not. There might be some out there, and I mean, one of the wonders which we've actually had in the last couple of years is the likes of, say, Gumtree or Facebook Marketplace, which have enabled people to, if they've got surplus hay in the shed, they can advertise it on there, and it's broadcast to quite a large area, and it's targeted to those people who really want to buy it. So we've seen a lot of that actually in the last couple of weeks, where people have been able to procure hay, or if they've got surplus, they've been able to sell it, and I've bought some off of Facebook Marketplace. Like larger quantities of big square bales, and they post it, and 25 minutes later I'll give them a call and it's sold. So, we're very fortunate that we've got that network that people can source hay to get them through, which is going to help, but if the hay's not there, it's not really going to help at all.
Yeah, if it's not there, as you say. And meantime, you mentioned your seeding, so you'll be hoping that there'll be some rain to sort of get that going very
yeah,
soon?
There's a lot of dust around the district. Everyone's going flat chat, dry seeding. I think there's one positive, I think, with this year, though, is the area of hay and the demand for oat and hay seed, the demand for wheat and hay seed was a lot greater than I've ever seen this year. So I think the planted area of hay this year is going to be up above the 5 or 10 year average. So that's probably a saving grace. But we've probably, what would be 2/3 through our seeding program at the moment. And there's no moisture in the soil, there's no moisture in the top 10 centimetres. So we're fairly confident that the seeds we're putting there are going to stay there, and the other part is there's no mice out there either, which means they can sit there for as long as they want without being eaten. We just need that little sprinkle of rain to get them germinated, and then the season will be up and away.
Now, there's some silver lining there, but certainly hoping that there are those good opening rains on their way sooner rather than later. It's Corbin Schuster, who is a hay producer at Frilling.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour. Well, Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers, he's had a big week announcing, of course, the federal budget. Today, he's in Port Augusta for another big announcement for many South Australians. The federal government's providing $65 million to investigate and progress planning for Northern Water. That's a project to look at delivering desalinated water and supporting renewable industries. Isabella Carboni is our reporter there for the announcement and joins us from Port Augusta. Good afternoon, Isabella.
Oh, it's a good afternoon to you, Selena.
So just give us an idea, what is today's announcement all about?
So what it was is a significant contribution to the Northern Water Project. So the Federal Treasurer announced that the Labor government will provide $65 million towards investigating and progress the planning for the Northern Water Project. Now, this is in combination with funds that have already been contributed by the state government. That's already been announced, and also some other takers that are in it. So, Selena, if you remember, a little while ago we had the Upper Spencer Gulf Economic Forums where they announced, the State Prosperity Project and all about hydrogen, water and copper mining. So the Northern Water Project is going to there's a desalination plant planned for Cape Hardy on the Upper Spencer Gulf, and that will transport water to Whyalla, where they plan to put in a hydrogen electrolyzer there and a hydrogen plant to create hydrogen. And that water will also be transported further north. We're talking up to Roxby Downs, because what's happening there is there's a number of mines that they say will be really key for the future. So that's including at Carrapateena for copper, Roxby Downs, Olympic Dam, and they're looking for a climate independent water source to help fund these supply these mines, which are currently drawing on the Great Artesian Basin, which is under extreme stress from this.
Mm. So some water-hungry, industries and wanting to grow them. So this is about sort of taking that pressure off the existing water supplies there.
Yeah, and just also providing water for the hydrogen plant planned for Whyalla, which is a really key part. This notion of green hydrogen is a really key part of how Australia and South Australia now plans to, future-proof their industry, become a key hydrogen creator. And that was made evident in Tuesday night's budget with the Future Made in Australia plan announced.
Now, the money, I know you've touched on it there for what it will be used for. This isn't about laying pipes and infrastructure. This is a planning stage funding?
Yes, that's it. So they're looking to put together, these really detailed plans, because all of these elements of, the hydrogen plant, the desalination plant there in the Upper Spencer Gulf, and copper mining, and other, there's some important critical minerals that are going to be used for things like solar panels and wind turbines and all of those things, and also green steel, are all considered really important for the future of the Australian economy. But first they need to investigate and progress just the planning stage.
And I guess a lot of talk up today, no doubt, from the politicians involved about what this is going to mean for South Australia. This has a lot of potential for unlocking value in the state.
That's exactly it. So what the federal government spokespeople have said is that this project has the potential to unlock $5 billion in investment and lift South Australia's gross domestic product by over $150 billion over its lifetime, up to 2053 we're talking, and, 4,200 jobs across all of it each year. So there's a lot of high numbers that are being thrown at us with this project.
And mining is really the main or key industry set to benefit out of this?
Mining and hydrogen production.
And Isabella, I know that the announcement today, the interesting location, Sundrop Farms at Port Augusta,
yes.
I mean, was it just a random choice, or are they looking to benefit from this?
Well, they themselves won't benefit from this, but it's just really interesting. Now, Selena, I'm not a rural reporter, so please go easy on me with my ag knowledge. But I don't know if you remember much about Sundrop, but it was started in 2016. I chatted to the owners a bit while I was there to get an idea of why did the federal treasurer and Minister for Environment and also the state treasurer and acting premier all choose this location in Port Augusta. Obviously, the location in the Upper Spencer Gulf is great, but Sundrop Farms is really interesting. They have this focus on sustainable farming, and the way they do that is through concentrated solar power. So they have Let's have a look. See, what have I got? Mirror fields. So they have 31 acres of mirrors that move with the sun as the sun moves across the sky and reflect that light back onto a tower, which then heats water. Now, that steam is used to produce electricity, which powers a desal plant that then is used, that clean water is used to irrigate their plants. But also the hot water itself is used then to heat the greenhouses to, create that heat needed for tomato production, because that's what they do there. And they produce about 14% of the country's tomatoes there just out of Port Augusta.
That is very cool. You did very well, Ashura, taking us through that very convoluted process, but a great example of things being done differently. Isabella, thanks so much for crossing into the program today.
Oh, pleasure, Selena. You have a good day.
Isabella Carboni there, our reporter at Port Augusta, for that announcement today. And as you heard, yeah, there's a cast of thousands there for that big announcement, the Northern Water Supply Project, a $65 million investment from the federal government. If it goes ahead, we're told it could see the construction of a new 260 megalitre per day seawater desalination plant at Cape Hardy, and approximately 600 kilometres of pipeline to the far north of South Australia. Along with that $65 million from the federal government, the state government and industry have jointly funded a $230 million package of work in the Northern Water Supply Project as well. It is 15 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Now, are you a fan of fish and chips from your local takeaway? If your order regularly is flake, you may be surprised that a new study has found that much of Australia's shark meat is mislabeled. Macquarie University conservation biologist and co-author of the study, Professor Adam Stowe, says instead of gummy shark, flake being sold in Australia is often other endangered species.
What we did was we went and sampled shark fillets that were labelled as shark from a range of fish and chip type shops and also fish wholesalers. And what we did was we had a look at the labels that were assigned to those fillets, and then we genetically identified the fillets to work out the species of origin. And essentially, what we found was that a large number, in fact 70% of the samples, were mislabeled. That is, the label was either uninformative or the label didn't correspond to the species of origin.
So what kind of fish, I guess, were being sold as sharks then that weren't?
A whole range. Most of it was in fact shark, but just different species to the label. In fact, one of the things that we found was some of the species were indeed endangered species. So why this is of concern, to me at least, is that there are sustainable shark fisheries in Australia, and one of the most common labels that we came across is the label of flake. And I think many people would be familiar with that label, flake. You go into a fish and chip shop and you ask for flake, and it's known to be shark. And what actually a lot of consumers now recognise is that flake is supposed to be the label for gummy shark. And gummy shark is, in fact, a sustainable fishery. And eating fish, it's a lovely fish to eat. The fillets are quite tasty. So it's sustainable. People often seek flake out because it's a sustainably harvested fish. But the issue is that a large portion, 88% or so, the samples labelled as flake weren't in fact a gummy shark.
So who's at fault here? I imagine the shop would think that they are selling gummy shark. Where do the other specimens kind of make their way into the production chain?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think there's anything particularly sinister going on here. I think it is quite a complicated business. The supply chain can be quite complicated, from port to plate, so to speak. And, it's hard to trace that. And the other issue is that a lot of sharks actually, different species of shark, actually look quite similar. Particularly, a lot of the whaler sharks look quite similar, and so it's unless you're an expert, it's kind of hard to distinguish them. And furthermore, once you start processing the catch and you remove bits and pieces of the carcass, it then becomes even harder to identify. So I think just along the supply chain, as you said, these errors creep in.
So what needs to be done to fix this problem then?
Yeah, look, I think there does need to be a tighter legislated, or mandated rather, labelling system so that the consumer can have trust in what they're buying. I think that's fairly fundamental. So at the moment, it's not mandatory. And, terms kind of, vague terms are quite common in the marketplace, and I think that just needs to be tightened up. So, yeah, I think it's just a process of going through, coming up with mandated labels and thinking through a way to ensure that we can be confident that the labels match the species. And I think part of that might also involve, a form of monitoring, and the sorts of genetic approaches that we applied could in fact be applied quite broadly and efficiently by means of monitoring.
And in the absence of a system you were outlining that really does check and certify the sharks, is there anything consumers can do if they're concerned about the type of shark they're eating?
That's a great question, and it's difficult because you really need the sort of molecular approach. Once you have a fillet, it's very difficult to be sure. So what I would say is that first, be aware of what the sustainable fisheries are when we're talking about fisheries more broadly. And when we're talking about sharks, then gummy shark, which is supposed to be flake, is a sustainable fishery. So I'd say the consumer should be aware of which stocks are being sustainably fished. And then the second thing that I think the consumer could do, at least as a starting point, is just ask the question. Because as I said, I don't think vendors are necessarily doing this on purpose. And I think if they are aware that there is consumer demand and that consumers are really quite interested in being confident that they've got a sustainably sourced shark, then, that might provide a bit more motivation to tighten things up.
That was Macquarie University conservation biologist and study co-author, Professor Adam Stowe, and he was speaking to Elsie Adamo. Well, for you craft beer lovers out there, would you try camel dung beer? Well, Robetown Brewery in the southeast is about to launch their brand new Holy Smokes, which is made by using camel dung as the fuel to smoke the malted barley. That's how it gets into the process. Well, owner and head brewer Maris Bizaitis says the new beer was inspired by the neighbouring camel farm, Humpalicious.
We've been running a little brewery in Robe for nearly 10 years now and really enjoy doing all sorts of unique and interesting things using, especially using the stuff that's around, some local stuff. So when I befriended the people that run the local camel dairy, I wanted to make a beer with something from the camels. I was racking my brain for quite a few weeks and eventually, realised that I think just about the only thing I could use from the camel to make a beer is the dung.
So tell me about this process, and what did TJ and the crew from Humpalicious say when you reached out to them and asked if you could utilise their camel waste?
Yeah, look, initially they were a little bit hesitant about the idea as well, but I can assure you that there is no dung that actually comes into the beer. What I use the dung for is to smoke the malt. So malted barley is smoked, cold smoked, with the camel dung used as the fuel. So there might be people out there that maybe smoke their brisket with some beechwood chips or cherry wood chips, but we smoke the malt with camel dung.
Why do that? Why smoke the dung in the process? What does it give the beer?
Oh. Yeah, well, look, actually, it's not the dung that's smoked, but it's the malt that is smoked by burning the dung. So, people have been cooking with dung and preserving, like smoking foods with dung for thousands of years. It has happened a lot in the past. Dung is a natural kind of fuel source for just cooking food, really. It's an readily available thing. If you've got animals around, it usually dries out fairly well. And, I think the flavour is something akin to like a peat-smoked malt. It doesn't smell or taste any, dungy or anything like that. Yeah, actually, I was quite surprised to find how little of, the little camel flavour there is in the dung-smoked malt.
Little camel flavour.
Yeah,
very, very.
Nothing unusual about it, really.
No, that's brilliant to hear. I mean, you were saying you were thinking about what you could use from the camels. Did the milk or the cheese not cross your mind?
Yeah, it did cross my mind. I mean, one could use, for example, whey in beer, the leftover from cheese, milk, and whey. It just doesn't really mix with beer flavors in my mind. I mean, they didn't really want to use any body parts or anything like that. But the dung, you know, when I came up with the idea, I wasn't sure about it 100%, but did a bit of research, was wondering whether anybody else has ever done anything like that. And soon enough, I found a distillery in Iceland that makes a whiskey from sheep dung smoked malt. So I thought, well, if the sheep dung can smoke the malt and make a good whiskey, I'm sure that the camel dung will do the same.
And how important is it to you personally to be able to come up with these flavours that reflect, you know, local produce and sustainability?
It's quite satisfying and fun just doing, you know, being creative, using the things that come across you in your life and things that you can stumble across. I mean, we forage for local fruits and berries and herbs and things around the area where we are. And yeah, it's all a bit of, you know, fun creativity, really. We like doing things, you know, that are kind of unique and not done before.
Owner and head brewer at Robetown Brewery, Maris Bizatis there. The Robetown Brewery is not the only one in the industry getting creative. Unusual beers have become increasingly popular in recent years as businesses try to keep up in a competitive market. Independent Brewers Association SA chapter lead Steve Brockman says consumers are increasingly seeking out brews with a local influence.
So we're seeing a real push from customers out there for some sort of local malt or ingredients being put in their beer. And it's a great way for our local breweries to kind of showcase what's available and around them, just like Robetown's done with that camel dung beer.
And unique flavours as well, keeping people coming back?
Yes, well, so the festival that Maris was just talking about there, the Great Australasian Beer Spectacular, has about 100 different beers, so they're always trying to find a different ingredient to stand out. So at the current moment, I know that Mismatch up in Adelaide has brewed a frog cake ale, so that's celebrating the South Australian icon, which is pretty cool. And there's some weird and wonderful beers that have come over the years. So I think Big Shed Brewing up in Adelaide also did a chicken salt goza, so a chicken salt sour beer, so in collaboration with Mitani, the chicken salt producers. So there's the ability to kind of use some iconic flavours into beer.
Wow, that's remarkable. And just how important is it to have these kinds of, well, I suppose gimmicks, but also, you know, important ventures into beer brewing to keep locals supporting their brewers?
Well, totally. It's really important. The beer industry, you might be able to open up paper or see the news and see that the beer industry is hurting a bit at the moment. Costs have gone up, transport costs have gone up, ingredient costs have gone up. So sometimes you might need a little bit of a gimmicky beer just to get people in the door. But it's really important to, like, reach out to the locals, let them know that there's some good beers. We're not as stuffy maybe as wine or spirits. We're a little bit more creative in craft beer. So, yeah, if it gets people in the door to try the camel dung beer, but then you can try a whole bunch of other different beers, that's kind of the aim there.
Yeah. What are some of the weirdest or most unique flavours that you've ever seen on the market yourself that you've tried?
I've tried quite a few of them. So I did try that chicken salt beer from last year or the year before. That was quite fun. I'm a big fan of using fruit. At the current moment at my brewery, which is Bright Star Brewing in Theberton, we've got a beetroot and ginger sour ale. So it's called Quizzing. That's in collaborations with Quizmeisters, who people might be familiar with. But yeah, any kind of flavour can work. You just got to make sure that the base beer itself kind of works with that flavour. So yeah, the world is your oyster. Oysters actually are a particularly good ingredient. I have had oysters. And if any of the listeners are familiar with what a Rocky Mountain oyster is, I'll let you kind of work that one out. It's not from a seafood, but maybe from a land animal. A Rocky Mountain oyster was in a stout in a beer that I drank in Colorado once.
Yeah, someone filled me in as to how you make one of those, and I say no thank you. That is Steve Brockman from the Independent Brewers Association of South Australia speaking to Beck Chave. You can read more about that on abc.net.au/rural. And just a simple text that's come in that says, what the dung beer? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Hey, give it a try. Let me know what you think of it. 2 minutes to one. Hello and happy Friday to Nikolai Balhartz.
Good afternoon. This afternoon we're going to, well, there's a lot to talk about, but one thing we're going to be discussing is something that's actually happening in New South Wales, but whether or not this could spread to South Australia and the far west, I suppose, is there's a company, an electricity company called Ausgrid, and they've got about 280,000 customers. They've announced that they're going to introduce a new tariff that will charge solar panel owners for exporting energy during the middle of the day. So, you know, normally you get, albeit a very small amount, you get a little bit of money back because you're feeding into the grid. Well, this company is now saying, actually, that's not very convenient, so we're going to start charging you if you export too much. Which what? Is, yeah, it's, well, the, so the argument is that there's too much power into the grid and it causes all these problems. We're going to try and get to the bottom of exactly what the issue is here, but it does seem on the surface to be a bit contradictory to the put solar on your roof, you might save some money, it's good for the environment, all of those things. Now you might actually have to pay, albeit a very small amount, back to the company.
Yeah, well, I want to know more about that, so I'll be tuning in. Nikolai Balhartz, he'll bring you that story. Stick around for this afternoon. Thanks for your company. I'll catch you Monday. News time.
Have you downloaded the ABC Listen app yet? Make sure you tap the heart and make your local ABC radio station one of your favourites. We are one of your favourites, aren't we?
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.